You are listening to KTOO Juneau, K2 News at 104.3, where the time is 3 o'clock in the afternoon. This is Cheryl Snyder. I'll be your host today for a Juneau afternoon. Coming up in the next hour, we'll hear from Kathy Colcourse Ruddy about her selection as one of AWARE's Women of Distinction. We'll learn about Friday's fireside lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, Living with Bears in Juneau, with guest Ryan Scott. And we'll talk with Kim Naylor from the City Museum about the 12 by 12 show, which is opening tonight. That, and of course, we'll have Writer's Almanac, National Native News, and some music to boot. The weather forecast for the rest of today shows that we'll have rain showers likely. Snow level will be at 1,100 feet with highs around 40, southeast winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. For tonight, numerous rain showers will happen in the evening, and then we'll have some scattered snow showers late. Snow accumulation will be to 1 inch or less with snow level at 1,200 feet. For tomorrow, we can expect it to be mostly cloudy with isolated rain and snow showers in the morning, isolated rain showers in the afternoon, highs around 38. And for tomorrow night, decreasing clouds, isolated snow showers, lows around 27, southeast winds 5 miles per hour. We're going to go now to National Native News.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. After months of stalled efforts addressing the Violence Against Women Act, U.S. House leaders paved the way for the measure to be reauthorized with new tribal provisions Thursday. Matt Laszlo has more from Washington.
Some Republicans raised constitutional questions about allowing courts in Indian Country to prosecute non-natives who abuse Native women. But those complaints gave way, and Republican leaders allowed the Senate version of the bill to pass. Others don't like that the Senate version of the Violence Against Women Act extends protections to the LGBT community and undocumented workers. The bill overwhelmingly passed the Senate, but was stalled for months in the House. Maryland Democrat Chris Van Hollen says he's glad Republican leaders relented and finally allowed the Senate bill to come up for a vote.
When you have an extreme Tea Party wing of the Republican caucus, the only way to get moderate bipartisan legislation passed is by allowing the full House to work its will. And that's the way the place should work.
The agreement leaders worked out was a two-step process. Republicans voted on an alternative GOP bill that only garnered 166 votes. After it went down in defeat, the full House passed the Senate version by a margin of 286 to 138. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
In Alaska this weekend, thousands of people will turn out for the start of the Iditarod Sled Dog Race from Anchorage to Nome. Kids of all ages will also follow the race from school. KNBA's Jocelyn Estes has more.
Iditarod Education Director Diane Johnson says 300,000 to 500,000 children around the world will be following the Iditarod Sled Dog Race as teachers use it in lessons in math, science, and social studies, as well as goal setting, teamwork, and Alaska Native cultures.
We strive to talk about the importance of the elders in the communities along the trail, and that's really important for kids living anywhere, to recognize how important it is to listen to what our elders have to say, to show respect and to be responsible, and to think about the traditional values and the traditional ways of learning.
Every year, a teacher is selected to prepare curriculum and maintain a journal during the race. This year's teacher on the trail is Linda Fenton of Wapaka, Wisconsin. She says the race is a great educational tool because it embodies everything children love: dogs, competition, and adventure. Teaching materials for preschool through high school are online at iditaroteducation.com. Reporting in Anchorage, Alaska, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
Services are scheduled for Saturday in Kayenta, Arizona, for Navajo Marine Jonathan Davis. The 34-year-old died in Afghanistan last week while conducting combat operations. The Marine Corps Times reports Davis joined the service in 1997 and was a Purple Heart recipient with combat experience in Afghanistan and Iraq. Flags on the Navajo Nation are at half staff in his honor. According to the tribe, he's the 13th Navajo military member to be killed in action in Iraq or Afghanistan. A Navajo Code Talker is being honored in Wisconsin. Chester Nez is scheduled to speak at Northland College tonight and will receive a plaque recognizing his military service from the governor's office. According to the college, Nez is being highlighted as part of Indigenous Cultures Awareness Month. Tribal leaders are preparing to address issues facing their communities with the Obama administration and members of Congress. The National Congress of American Indians Legislative Summit is scheduled to take place next week in Washington, D.C. Speakers include a White House advisor, cabinet secretaries, and nearly a dozen lawmakers. During this month in 1865, the Colorado River Indian Reservation was established. The reservation spans the Colorado River and has land in Arizona and California. It's home to four different tribes. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC-CLIC-GIVE when filing online for your PFD. When you select KNBA-FM, Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, you support National Native News. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska. Native Voice One. The Native American Radio Service.
You are listening to Native Voice One on KTOO News at 104.3, where the time is 3:06 in the afternoon. This is Cheryl Snyder, and I am a host today on a Juno afternoon. I'm joined in the studio now by Sarah Lynn Tabachnik, which she is the executive director for AWARE, and also Kathy Cole Horst Ruddy, who is being honored this year as one of AWARE's Women of Distinction. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
And Kathy,
you.
Congratulations on this big honor.
Thank you very much.
I thought we could first start, Sarah Lynn, by talking about what exactly is AWARE for those in the listening audience that don't know, and then maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the Women of Distinction program is.
Great. Thanks, Cheryl. AWARE stands for Aiding Women in Abuse and Rape Emergencies. AWARE is the Domestic Violence Sexual Assault Program serving Juneau and Northern Southeast Alaska. We provide intervention services as well as prevention services. We also oversee the Juneau Batterers Accountability Program. We're pretty comprehensive throughout Northern Southeast and throughout Juneau in terms of our programming and what we offer. We have a crisis line that's available 24 hours a day. 1-800-478-1090. If someone themselves needs some support, or if someone has a question or would like to help a friend. Which brings us then.
Yeah, so the Women of Distinction, how does this honor that you offer for women each year, how does that fit into the program that you run?
Right. So our mission of empowering women, of women recognizing their own strength, finding their own strength, their inner voice, on the one hand. And then, of course, we have women in our community who every day are doing work, volunteer work, paid work, sometimes behind the scenes, sometimes front and center, that really supports AWARE's mission of peace and freedom and empowerment and joy. The community nominates women which the AWARE Board of Directors then looks at all the nominations and has the difficult task, actually, of choosing four women to honor each year.
That's actually a nice thing that there are so many women doing such fabulous things in town that it's tough to pick them.
It's true. It's so fun because, you know, I've been in Juneau a long time. I know women often. And then I read their nomination forms and I learn so much about women, the women whose names I know or who I know peripherally. So it's really exciting.
So what are the key qualities that you look for when you're going through the submissions?
Well, we look for women who have done things in a broad base, so not necessarily singularly focused, although sometimes the depth of service that women provide is exceptional and we really want to honor that as well.
So, Kathy, maybe you can speak to some of the work that you've been doing in Juneau for many years that got you this great distinction.
Well, first of all, I just want to say that AWARE is such a sort of an essential group for Juno, and it's a pleasure to support them. They do such good work with what they have, and as I think you'll hear, they're trying to build a new building because the shelter that they have now is quite full. So it's a pleasure to support them. I'm a community builder. I'm an attorney, and I've been thrilled to be in Juneau for about 35 years and to appreciate what binds us together and what helps us shine and help each other. And so I've just tried to do my best.
So can you speak to some of the specific things you've done in Juneau?
I think the bio that we hammered out has several boards, board leadership, Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, Juneau Symphony, bringing Natalie Rothaus to town. That's one thing I appreciate. I was very proud of. And then also Mel Flood. I was part of the team that hired Mel Flood. Then I've been on the board of directors of Juneau Jazz and Classics since the beginning, and we're 27 years old. I'm helping with the Whale Project that's just about to put the Skip Wallen Whale within the year down by Bridge Park. For the Alaska statehood, I was a child in Kodiak before statehood, and so I had a historic perspective that I was really pleased to work with Peter Metcalf on a volume called The Sword and the Shield, which is about the success of the Alaska Native Brotherhood before statehood in preventing the extinguishment of Aboriginal claims. It was very close, and I don't think people know that. So those are some of the things that have inspired me in addition to my daytime job as an attorney.
So all of these things that you've done to help support and bolster our community, where do you think that comes from in you?
Oh, that's the speech that I'm trying to write now that in 6.5 minutes we'll try to inspire the audience tomorrow night. You know, gosh, it's so close now. It seems like we've been planning for 6 months. But so tomorrow night at Centennial Hall, I'll be trying to speak about the things that have inspired me and how maybe it might inspire other people. I started this morning with my mom. And, you know, she was raised a Quaker, and she believed in that there was a spirit in everything and that there was she respected all life. And I think a lot of my comments are going to turn on respect, and that connects with the governor's Choose Respect theme that he's been working on. And so I hope I'll be able to say something interesting tomorrow night.
Well, knowing you, I'm sure that you will.
Yes.
What have been some of your pet projects of all of these things that you've done over the years? Which ones have been nearest and dearest to your heart?
I think Juneau Jazz and Classics has been nearest and dearest to my heart because when I lived in Connecticut, I managed bands, traditional jazz bands. And so when I felt I had some skills to help Linda Rosenthal when 27 years ago she thought it would be fun to start a festival. That one is near and dear to my heart. And then also I think on this Sword and the Shield, because I always wanted to know. I came as a clerk for Bob Boutchiever, and I always wanted to know what Aboriginal title meant. You know, what did it mean? People would say, oh, that's just Indian title. What was it? So fortunately with this investment, Rasmussen invested $1 million in the Alaska Humanities Forum, and they distributed it to reimagine and review 50 years of statehood, because of course there were people alive who were there at the beginning of the state, like little me. You know, I was 7 years old, and so that Sword and the Shield project is also really near and dear to my heart. We're reissuing it with photographs, I hope the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood get the attention that they deserve, in part because of this Sword and the Shield.
And what have been some of the most challenging projects that you've worked on or volunteer efforts that you've been engaged in?
Oh, I remember the Juneau Symphony years ago. Now, this was like 25 years ago. There were just lots of centrifugal force on the symphony. That was one thing. That was a challenge. But they sure have come through with flying colors, you know. After Mel Flood stayed with us for 17 years, and I felt really pleased with having been part of the selection for that. oh, nothing else is coming to mind. We all have failures all the time, and we try to respond to our failures, but nothing is popping into my head.
I think that's great. I think you've given our listeners a lot. So you are a lawyer, you're a mother, you are a very involved community member. How do you juggle it all?
Well, when I was practicing law full-time and had two small children, there was the challenge, you know, there was the big challenge. And, you know, I sometimes felt as if I had no brain cells available, you know. But with planning ahead and with childcare, you know, with reliable childcare that we all need, as you know, and with planning ahead and with getting your support network for contingency planning, that's the kind of preparation that we all can do as mothers of small children. And then once they grow up, they, you know, they're off on their own, and you get your free time back.
Well, congratulations again on this very well-deserved honor. Sarah Lynn, can you tell us quickly who some of the other honorees are tomorrow night?
Sure. This year we'll be honoring Mary Ellen Arvold, Jackie Martin, and Colleen McKenzie tomorrow evening. We'll be at Centennial Hall. The doors open at 5:30. There's a silent auction. We have over 150 items. Isn't that amazing? It's going to be great.
All donated from local businesses and organizations.
Right. And Tom Loker will play some music. And then at 7 o'clock, the program will begin. We'll begin with Mark Calvert, who will sing a song, and accompanied by Tom Loker. And then the women will have dinner, catered by the Baranoff, sit-down dinner. Mm-hmm. And then the women, each woman has 7 to 8 minutes to speak about what inspires her. And she'll also be introduced by a person of her choice, who will have 2 minutes to introduce their woman of distinction.
Sounds terrific. For those who do not have tickets yet but would like to attend, I'm assuming there are maybe one or two, three or four left.
You're right. I think we're into single digits. The number to call is AWARE at 586-6623.
Do you think it also makes sense that if someone doesn't get a ticket today, they could show up at the door and potentially, if not all the seats are full, they could get in?
It's possible.
Uh-huh.
But I wouldn't count on it. So
Don't delay.
Yes.
Okay, terrific. Well, do you want to take a moment to just talk real briefly about your plans to build a new facility?
Thank you. That's great. We are intending to build extended stay shelter for women and families leaving our emergency safe shelter. Right now, we are an emergency shelter. It's very difficult for women to find housing, actually for most people in Juneau, to find affordable housing. Mm. We're hoping to build 6 units where we can offer supportive services where women and families can stay after they leave our emergency shelter. They can be there for 3 months, 6 months, 18 months, kind of depending on the need. Have some time to really build some safety and stability before moving into independent living.
Now, if there are individuals who would like to be involved in this project, either by donating or volunteering in some way, is there information on your website that people can learn more?
There is information on our website. And if you ever are looking at our website, awareak.org, and don't find something, please call. We're a friendly group, and really want to share information.
They have a wonderful newsletter, and they have a wonderful wish list also. Oh, yeah. There's always something interesting on their wish list.
All right. Terrific. Well, Sarah Lynn Tabachnik, Executive Director of AWARE, and Kathy Kolkhorst Reddy are one of the honorees in tomorrow night's Women of Distinction dinner. Thank you so much to the two of you for joining today. I hope you have a wonderful event tonight, and we look forward to other opportunities to have you both on the air.
Tomorrow night, AWARE.
Thank you. Thank you.
Listening to KTOO Juno, K2 News at 104.3, where the time is 3:22 in the afternoon. This is Cheryl Snyder, your host for a Juno Afternoon, and I am in the studio right now with Sally Schlichting and Christina Pollack, two members of the Juno Symphony. They are here to let us know about some events happening this weekend. So welcome to the two of you.
Thank you very much.
It's great that you guys could come in here. Why don't you tell us about this weekend's concerts?
Sure. Yeah, It's the Juno Symphony Showcase Concert. It's the second in a series of chamber music concerts this year, a set of actually four concerts that we're going to be having, four programs. And this weekend's concerts features musicians from the symphony, quite a number of them, probably at least 20, maybe more, and in an array of ensembles from duets, trios, a brass group, a string group. The piece I'm performing is for flute, tenor, string quartet, and piano, and there's also just a cello ensemble, which will be really exciting. It's just, I think, five cellos are playing a piece by Schubert, so it's going to be a great and varied program.
And trombone too.
Yep,
it's going to be fantastic to hear the brass too.
can you explain the difference between a chamber orchestra versus the full orchestra?
Well, in this case, it's not actually a chamber orchestra performing. It's just chamber groups, very small, typically small ensembles. But a chamber orchestra is just a smaller orchestra, and not as many. Like, you wouldn't have harp, and you wouldn't have some of the more exotic instruments in it. Maybe just very, very limited group, maybe 20 people, for example.
Yeah, usually one per part.
Yeah. So I can imagine in that smaller environment, each of you has to be totally prepared and on your game and ready to perform, because everything that you play is, you're representing your instrument in the ensemble.
That's right, for sure.
So how long do you prepare to do a show like this?
Well, I've been preparing this piece. We've been preparing it for probably a couple of months. I don't know. How about you and your piece?
I've been preparing it for about a month and a half, 2 months.
Christina's playing a piece with piano.
Yes.
And what is your instrument?
I'm a French horn player, like my father.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah. So is there any coordination between the musicians to shape the entire evening's program, or are you just each start to get together on your own and pick what you love and hope that it puts together a nice program for the night?
It's really interesting question for the showcase, because we've always talked about maybe trying to coordinate the pieces so that they maybe fit together in a theme or something like that, but we've never actually done that. So it's really much more of a varied program, and this one is a perfect example in that we have, you know, a violin and piano piece, a horn and piano piece. We have this more sort of unusual combination of instruments in my piece. And then we have a brass group. And then we have a newly composed piece. It's just written for this program by Tyree Peeney, which is for 14 string players. And that's going to be really exciting. We all just come together, we bring what we bring, and the public has loved it. The audience just goes, they love the variety.
Well, and I can imagine, too, it just becomes then such a reflection of all the different personalities of the performers who get up on stage. Yeah. Now, are there some musicians who get tapped to play with several different pieces because there might be only one fabulous French horn player in town, like one very well sought after? Or how does that end up working out?
Well, usually it's just a scheduling thing. There are some cases where people get tapped, like Sally gets tapped for a lot of flute stuff, and so does Jetta for oboe, and my dad is usually tapped a lot for French horn, not this concert, mostly because he's got a recital coming up. He's in the third of the chamber concert series with Candice Lavolsi and Beth Madsen Bradford on the third symphony chamber concert. It's going to be great in April, but most of the time, there are just so many great players and such a great pool of talent here in Juneau that there can be several. I mean, John Schumann and I are both on the program. We're both playing French horn. We've got four very competent trombone players. We've got all of these string players in Tyree's piece. I mean, it's fantastic. Yeah. It's really going to be a great concert with all the different people and all the different talent coming in.
Well, it is always amazing to me, especially because we're a community of 30,000 people, but just how many talented individuals, artists, musicians, performers choose to live here and share their talents with all of us. We're very fortunate.
Yeah, it's pretty rich here.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit more about Tyree's piece, the one that was created for this
weekend? I wish
that
I could, because I actually haven't heard it. It looks like six violins, two violas, two cellos, and two bass. Bass files. I think it's like a world premiere for us. So it'll be the first time we've all heard it, and I'm looking forward to it. I know that he has studied composition in college, and he's also quite a talented cellist himself.
And is he local?
And he's local, and he teaches at Thunder Mountain High School music program.
Terrific. So for those who we've now inspired to go get their tickets for this weekend, where are you showing and when, and how do people get their tickets?
You can get tickets at the door, and you can also get them at the usual outlets, like Hearthside Books, probably at the Jack, and I think they might still be available online, and Christina reminds me that.
There's a special deal for students at the door, $5. It'll be great, especially on Saturday evening at the 8 o'clock concert at the UAS Egan Library, because they can just come in from the dorms. $5, come in and see a great concert.
It's called
a great
experience. Student rush tickets, right? It's the classic thing that students get to do, yeah.
And then the Sunday performance is where?
It's at 3 p.m. At Northern Light United Church downtown, so...
Terrific. And then you guys are also performing in April, right? The full symphony?
The full symphony, yeah. We're performing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. We're still looking for lots of singers. It's a tremendous experience for the singers as well as the orchestra. And I just encourage the whole community to turn out, like, come sing, you know? So it'd be great. So you can go to our website and the JunoSymphony.org and look for information about that.
Okay. And just a note on that concert, that's going to be back at the high school. And K2 has a long history of doing live broadcasts of the symphony performances, the Sunday performance. For the last couple of years, we haven't been able to do that because of some equipment issues on our end, but we are like 9/10 of the way there to solving this problem. We think by that next concert that we'll be able to do the broadcast again.
Oh. So, that'll be so wonderful.
So we're working towards that.
Yeah, we have people around the country and around the world sometimes who listen in on that performance. So
yeah, well, even great. Me too, just as a listener, I remember one day being at the Rock Dump and they had one of your Sunday broadcasts just blasting through the entire climbing wall.
That's great.
You know, it was like one of those shivers up the back kind of moments, like, these are our Juno people doing this. This is fabulous. Yeah. So, well, thank you so much to the two of you, Sally Schlichting and Christina Pollock, for coming in today, and of course also for creating beautiful music for us this weekend and with all of the symphony performances.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
All right. Yeah. Well, all right. Thanks. All right. We are going to go to Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 1st of March, 2013. It's the birthday of the poet Robert Lowell, Boston, 1917, whose work established a new confessional style in American poetry, poems such as For the Union Dead, to speak of woe that is in marriage. As a young man, he left home in Boston, dropped out of Harvard, moved to Tennessee, pitched a tent on the lawn of the poet Alan Tate, converted to Catholicism, married the novelist Jean Stafford. During World War II, he became a conscientious objector, spent 5 months in a federal prison in Danbury, Connecticut. Went back to Harvard, studied with John Crow Ransom, wrote the poems that made up his first two collections, and won the Pulitzer Prize at the age of 30. and it was about that time he was hospitalized for mental illness for the first time, what would be the first of many, many times. He was bipolar. He had manic depressive disorder. He himself referred to his mania as pathological enthusiasm, described a manic episode as a magical orange grove in a nightmare. He was in and out of psychiatric hospitals throughout his adult life, frequented McLean's psychiatric ward in Boston, where Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath, two of his students, also went. Stories about his psychiatric episodes were famous around Harvard. Robert Lowell wandering around Harvard Square without a coat in the middle of January, shivering and wild-eyed and incoherent. And after his episodes, when he had regained his sanity, Lowell was inevitably embarrassed and wrote long letters of apology to people. But his disease was also his material, especially in the poems for his collection Life Studies, which came out in 1960. He was married to three writers, Jean Stafford, Elizabeth Hardwick, and then Lady Caroline Blackwood, with whom he moved to England for the last decade of his life. He was separated from her and in a taxi from JFK into New York City to visit his second ex-wife when he had a heart attack and died at the age of 60. It's the birthday of the poet Richard Wilbur, New York City, 1921. Served in the infantry in World War II, fought on the front lines, but when he wrote poems about the war, he wrote about the quiet, lonely moments. Richard Wilbur, who said, "I would feel dead if I didn't have the ability periodically to put my world in order with a poem. I think to be inarticulate is a great suffering." Here's a poem for today by Tom Hennen. Report from the West. Snow is falling west of here. The mountains have more than a foot of it. I see the early morning sky, dark as night. I won't listen to the weather report. I'll let the question of snow hang. Answers only dull the senses. Even answers that are right often make what they explain uninteresting. In nature, the answers are always changing, rain to snow, for instance. Nature can let the mysterious things alone, wet leaves plastered to tree trunks, the intricate design of fish guts, the way we don't fall off the earth at night when we look up at the North Star, the way we know this may not always be so, the way our dizziness makes us grab the long grass hanging by our fingertips on the edge of infinity. A poem by Tom Hennen, Report from the West, From Darkness Sticks to Everything, published by Copper Canyon Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You are listening to KTOO Juno, K2 News at 104.3. The time is 3:35 in the afternoon. I'm Cheryl Snyder. I'm the host for today's Juno Afternoon, and I'm joined in the studio by Ryan Scott, who is a wildlife biologist with ADF&G and tonight's fireside presenter at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. So, Scott, welcome.
Thank you, ma'am.
Now, you've been using radio satellite collar data to learn more about the bears in our area. What can you tell us about your research?
Yeah, so it's been a program that's been ongoing for a long time. Started in the early 2000s with one collar. It was new technology at that point. So my predecessors deployed that here locally. And since then, we've been able to do that, you know, with a bear or two, you know, every year or every other year. So really what we see is Frankly, what we see is we don't know as much about bears as we think we do. Bears do some pretty neat things in the way they use the landscape around Juneau. Not only an urban landscape like downtown Juneau, but the wild landscape, if you will, around neighborhoods, around the periphery of downtown, even looking in some of the different areas, different locations in Juneau. Take Douglas or downtown or the valley or the Mendenhall Glacier or something like that. So we can get a lot of insight, and we have gotten a lot of insight on what bears are up to.
What have been some of the big surprises?
Well, I guess a couple things. One, if you move a bear, they're quick to come back, generally speaking, which isn't a huge surprise, but how quickly they'll do it at times. Another big surprise is that even looking at some of the collar information, I've made the assumption over time that, you know, bears will venture down into these urban settings and neighborhoods downtown at night and then be gone during the day. What we often see is bears will hole up in places and they'll just wait. You know, they're very secretive that way.
So they understand that it's going to be quieter on the streets in the evening, and during the day they're going to get spotted and shoot away.
Yeah, I'm sure that plays a part of it. They're very active at night, and there's a seasonal component to that as well, be it spring, early summer, late summer, and in the fall. We definitely see some of that urban activity change over those periods. And then a lot has to do with what kind of natural foods out there and is available for them.
Now, you mentioned you're surprised at how quickly bears can come back to an area when you move them. What is the process of moving them? Do you do anything to try to disorient them so that they can't easily track their way back?
Yeah. If you really want to have some success with that, you've got to put a lot of water between you and the bear. But that's not a given that that's going to work. At times, we're limited by weather, people available, and we do other things by moving them on the road system. And, it has worked, but by and large, it doesn't. And they don't take long to get back to right where they were.
How many bears each season does ADF&G move?
Well, we try not to move very many, frankly. It's expensive, time-consuming, and it generally doesn't fix the problem. You know, we might move two or three. We do make an effort with females, with cubs, to move those if we get into a situation where we need to address what's going on. Really, the underlying problem is, why is the bear there? And generally speaking, it doesn't take us very long to figure out what food source they're using there. And it's most often a human food source.
Now, does moving that food source solve it, or has the bear at that point kind of damage done, that bear is going to keep going back?
No, damage is not done, at least from what we've been able to learn. And part of what we'll talk about tonight is actually keeping tabs on some of these bears we've moved to other locations and to see what happens with them. I would say that the bears, over time, what we've seen is they spend X amount of time in urban locations, usually taking advantage of human food sources, but they have a large component of their time spent in more wild settings, even on the periphery of downtown or in the valley, things like that. So bears know how to utilize natural food sources, and they can go on and live happy, long lives.
Now, you were mentioning before we got on the air that you've been seeing a lot of bears out this winter.
I haven't personally seen one, but we're getting a lot more reports this winter than typically we do in other winters. We'll usually hear about one or two, or somebody will cut some tracks somewhere, something like that. But just recently, as early as today, we've had an indication that a bear was out and about and moving around. Someone saw a bear today. So,
what do you contribute that to?
Well, I think it has a lot more to do with probably last fall, with some depressed fish runs in some of the local streams, a patchy berry crop. So if bears aren't energetically prepared to go into denning, they're going to get up and get moving, and they're going to need to feed. They're looking to forage. So I think a lot has to do what we're seeing with now probably has a lot more to do with last fall. And at times, I think some bears pick bad dens, and we've had a lot of warm weather, a lot of rain. So if they get wet, it gets soggy in there, they may want to get up and get moving as well.
So there's no real consequence to the bear, though, if they miss their three-month hibernation. It's all about calories in. If they don't get enough in the fall, they got to stay awake all winter, and there's no other consequence beyond that for them?
Well, the consequence, it could be the ultimate consequence if they aren't prepared. I mean, one of the reasons bears den is because of the limited food sources during the wintertime. So if, you know, if they do try to stay up, they're not going to find much to eat. And if they come out this time of year even, there's not a lot out there going yet. Even though it feels a little springy, you know, things haven't started to click yet on the beaches, and grasses aren't coming up, things like that. So,
and they can easily just go right back into hibernation if they come out, not enough food, go back in and sleep a little bit more.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know how easy it is. They certainly can go back in and bide their time, but metabolically and physiologically, I'm not sure how their body does with that, you know, fits and starts. Mm-hmm. But it certainly seems like we hear about bears out, and then we go for a period of time that we don't hear anything. So I make the assumption that they do go in, find that happy medium where they recognize there's nothing out there, and they'll come back out when it's time.
So what can folks expect when they come to your talk tonight at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center?
Well, hopefully it'd be really fun. You know, that's the point.
We
I
like
think.
Fun.
Yeah, exactly.
And bears are interesting creatures.
And bears are great. And, you know, Juno, like it or not, we can't help ourselves. We grow black bears really well. We have good habitat available for them. Unfortunately, we have some of that human food source problem going as well. So tonight, we're going to talk about a couple different projects we have going. One out at the Mendenhall Glacier, where we've marked some bears around the visitor center. We're also going to talk at length about a recent event that a couple years ago we had a bear feeding activity out in the Tea Harbor area. And instead of removing bears from there, we actually marked some of those, and we've been tracking those now for a couple years. They were going to provide some updates on bears. I did a similar presentation in 2008. And over the last several years, we've had some interesting insights from some of those bears that had collars back then. So we'll do some updating. And then it's really an opportune time to start thinking about bear season. And there's some exciting things going on there, too. Not only is it exciting to think about spring coming, and we've had some bear sightings, but there's some activity around Juneau with some people. A bear committee has been formed and working, and some other opportunities. And so it's just, yeah, there's a lot of things going on surrounding bears. So
sounds great. And what time are your talks tonight?
6:30 and 8 o'clock, two of them.
Yeah. Okay, and just a reminder to folks who maybe have never been to one of these events, they are free and open to the public. Depending upon the subject matter, the theater at the Visitor Center can fill up pretty quick. I've had the experience on more than one occasion being part of the standing room only in the back.
Yeah.
So I suspect tonight people are very interested in our local bears, and your research sounds really fascinating. So I suspect this is going to be one of those nights where a lot of people come out. So if you're interested in going, get there early enough.
Yep.
So, okay, again, at 6:30 and 8 o'clock tonight, you can head out to the Visitor Center and hear Ryan Scott talk about bears in our area. And do you have some slides, photos to go along with that presentation tonight? Or
yeah, lots. It's, you know, the collar data we present graphically, you know, via the slides, and lots of great bear pictures and, you know, gathered from lots of different people around Juneau. So.
All right. Terrific. And also just a heads up to folks, if those bears are out, we always need to sometimes, you know, it's only the end of February, but we always need to have our bear awareness around about us.
That's right. Yep. It's never too early to start thinking about it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming in tonight, Ryan, and good luck with your talks tonight.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
are listening to KTOO Juneau, K2 News at 104.3, where the time is 3:47 in the afternoon. This is Cheryl Snyder, your host for Juneau Afternoon today, and I am now joined in the studio by Kimberly Naylor. Welcome, Kimberly.
Thank you.
Kimberly, you work at the Juneau City Museum, and you are here to talk about the annual 12 by 12 exhibit, which is opening tonight as part of First Friday.
That's right. Yeah. It's the ninth annual, so we do it every year. It is displayed in March. We accept pieces in the end of February, and we do a theme every year. This year, the theme is Juneau Past and Present, so it's kind of, you know, anything Juneau-related. We have some really great submissions this year. We have several people that have submitted every year, and I can talk about them a little bit if that...
Yeah, that would be
okay.
Great.
Okay. So we have Tom Duran, and he does wonderful chalk pastels and has a piece titled Skiing in Northern Lights. We have Stacy Eldemare and Patrick Rip have innovative textural pieces again this year. Patrick Rip has a really fun piece. Alan Murano has once again submitted a piece. The Cosgrove family has a piece called More is Less, which is a must-see. It's very interesting. Nancy Roselle Brown has a clever take on the theme Juneau Past and Present. And Jeff Brown, the master of merriment, has once again submitted a piece, and his is really interesting. It's interactive. So great things this year.
What kind of materials have the artists used to create their 12 by 12 piece of art?
Oh, it's there's a wide variety. I would say it's mainly mixed media. Sherry McDonald and David Riccio both have pieces in the exhibit this year. And, you know, there's paint, there's mixed media paper, sculptural pieces. So, yeah, it kind of runs the gamut.
How many different artists are represented this year?
I think we have about 30 pieces in the gallery this year. We also have we usually do a youth class for the 12 by 12. And this year I went out and I taught at Floyd Dryden, and we did an after-school program called BAM. And so I taught about 8 students total. 7 students are exhibiting in this. So it's really exciting to see the work that they came up with, and they learned a lot about Juneau history in the process. So,
now, anyone who submits a piece of art will end up in the exhibit, or is
That's
there
right.
a jury process?
There's not really a jury process. The restriction is 12 by 12, so it has to be within those dimensions. Patrick Rip is a little outside of those dimensions, but he did such an interesting piece. And
does he do collage? I'm trying to remember. I know I've seen his work
Patrick
before.
Patrick Rip, his is kind of sculptural. Mm-hmm. You'll have to come see it because it is very exciting, a very interesting piece, a lot of movement. I'm not sure. I'm not as familiar with his work, but this year it's kind of a sculptural element. So.
And with the theme past and present, are you noticing certain elements that are similar between the different pieces?
Some people took it very literal, and they had, you know, early 1900s to now. Some people, you know, took a little bit more of a liberty. It was anything Juneau related was kind of the theme that we were trying to get across. But David Riccio, he has a dodecahedron, so he has a 12-sided figure that has images of the glacier. So he took images from all 12 months. So again, the theme 12, and he has that on the face of the dodecahedron. So it's really interesting.
Sounds fabulous. So
yeah.
What time are you opening the doors for people who want to check this exhibit out?
Yeah, so we open tonight, the first Friday, is 4:30 to 7:30, and then it's exhibited until April 13th. So
terrific. And is there anything else going on at the City Museum you'd like to tell us about while you're here?
Yes, as a matter of fact.
Terrific.
we have on March 16th, we have a coffee and collections with Sarah Aspersmith. If you're not familiar with her, she is the author and illustrator of Have You Seen a Smack of Jellyfish? And her new book, I Will Tuck You In. And she's doing a coffee and collections on the 16th, 10:30 to noon.
Can you explain what that is?
Coffee and collection? Sure. It's a free program. It's open to the public. It's kind of like a lecture series. And she'll be focusing on typography and her professional career as a storyteller and digital illustrations. So we have one about every month with, you know, local artists, anyone that we can kind of round up to do a presentation. So that's going on in March. And then we also have Juno Explorers, which is, it happens during spring break. So it's from Monday, March 18th to Friday, March 22nd. And it's from 12:30 to 4:30. And it's a youth program. We're doing lots of fun things this year, lots of field trips, lots of really great art activities. And it's very reasonable. I've worked with children in children's programs, and it's a very reasonable price, and we're doing great things. So look for that on our website. We also have the 100th centennial, the celebration for the legislature, the territorial legislature, and that's with the Gastineau Channel Historical Society. And that's on Saturday, March 30th from 10:30 to noon. So it's another coffee and collection style, but it's hosted by the Gastineau Channel Historical Society and the museum co-sponsors. So that'll be very interesting.
Terrific. Well, there certainly are a lot of good reasons to head up to the City Museum, in particular this evening, for the opening of the 12 by 12 exhibit. And again, that's going to be going on until April 13th.
It'll be exhibited until April 13th. Yes.
Okay, terrific. Well, thank you so much, Kimberly Naylor, for coming on down here this afternoon and filling us in on all of the great programs you have going right now.
Thank you.